This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship. For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org or call 800-698-7884.
Well, well, well. So, how's everybody enjoyed the conference so far? Good, yeah. Got more excitement to come, so. This used to be in July, and it feels like July, every bit of July out. So, all of the memories from last year feel exactly the same walking around. So, we're sure glad you've had a chance to come out. And for those of you that are outside the Columbus area or outside the United States, it seems like one of the exciting things I've really enjoyed is the chance to meet international and guests and folks around the country, folks from other churches here in the Columbus area, as well as meeting new faces in a fellowship the size of Xenos. One of the things we always encourage each other to do is to introduce yourself to someone you don't know, because it's often the case someone's been here longer than I have, but it's a chance to meet a new face or somebody that's here for the first time. So anyway, welcome. My name's John Rue, and this is Connie. And we've been married, I guess it'll be for 22 years, by God's grace, in September. Wonderful. And why don't I open us up in a word of prayer. Father, thank you for this life that you've given us. Thank you for the answers that you give us as we, each one of us is like Jim Leffel and Tom Stipe. We're saying that maybe it was as a 9-year-old as we called out to you, when things in our family were really in a difficult period, or as we encountered some of the real challenges of life, that maybe this thing that we suspected was not really true, that you weren't there, and what a hopeless situation that would be. Thank you for coming into my life late into, my 20s, and really for showing me at the age of 30 just what an awesome difference it makes knowing you, Lord, and that as we come into this relationship with you, you shower us with this gift called grace, and then you also give us a purpose and a privilege of being an ambassador to a world that's just like us in so many ways, except that many of these folks don't understand who you are, they have misconceptions, and that it's through just relationships of the ordinary people that are connected in one another's lives that that's how, your message is designed to be delivered. So help us learn some practical things that we can take away from this conference, from this session. We pray for your wisdom, and just that you'd help us clear our hearts to hear the things you'd have for each of us today. Yeah. In Christ's name, amen. So, well, Connie and I are now on staff here at Xenos. We have large meetings like most churches on the weekends, and in our case we have 4 adult meetings that meet in this facility, so we're sitting in one of the children's classrooms, and we also have 2 separate college meetings that go on down in the campus area. With our adult ministries, what we've done is taken approximately the 100 home groups that Xenos has, adult home groups, and organized those around the 4 different meeting times on the weekends, so that there's a sense of community, and then also a way for, from an oversight or a pastoral standpoint, that we can provide more regional or what we call a sphere oversight, pastoral oversight, to each of these congregations. So Connie and I are on staff to oversee our Saturday meeting, of which there are approximately 25 home groups, and in that role, we provide a lot of coaching and working with different home group leaders, and one of the main things that we're always talking about is this idea of lifestyle evangelism. Mm-hmm. So, Connie, I think this is a good segue to you.
So, I just want to talk for a few minutes on why we're talking about lifestyle evangelism. And the reason we're talking about it is not because we're on staff at Xenos Christian Fellowship. The reason we're talking about it is not necessarily because we're home church leaders and have our own home group in our own home. On a personal level, the reason we are, so committed to lifestyle evangelism is because God reached us through lifestyle evangelism. through people who were committing their lives to God's priorities and giving His way, love away, to the people who were laying on the side of the road, as George talked about last night, and needed a good Samaritan to come and help rescue us. 15 years ago, I called myself an atheist, and we weren't living for Christ. If you had told me I would be working at a church and evangelizing for Christ, I would have told you that you were smoking crack. Because I was a hostile atheist, and we lived our lives for ourselves. John's God was his work. My God was him and our kids. And we had no room for God in our lives until our 3-year-old son died 4 days after Christmas for no reason and with no expectation that that was going to happen. And the fabric of our lives changed that day in a moment. In a moment, we went from thinking we were walking down the road to laying on the side of the road nearly dead. And fortunately, God reached out to us through some friends who shared the love of Christ with us, who came and sat with us when no one else could stand to be around our pain because it was just too great for some of our friends to endure. They couldn't stand to be with us. And so on a very personal level, we're here talking about lifestyle evangelism because that's how we were reached for Christ. So that's on a personal level. On a biblical level, we're here talking about lifestyle evangelism because that's what Jesus has commissioned us to do as believers in Christ. He said, you know, look, I want you to go and take the love that I've given you out to people who don't know that love. Out to people who even question whether you exist or there's any possibility to have your love in their lives. And that's what I want you to live your life around. And then on a practical level, what we've learned in our own home groups, but also what we've learned here in Xenos, is that lifestyle evangelism is effective. Yeah. You know, Jim last night said 80% of the people that are here at Xenos, and we're at what? 4,000 adults or something close to that. 80% of the 4,000 of us are unchurched. We came from unchurched backgrounds, which means a number of us were non-Christians coming into this church. And it is primarily through the cell-based ministry of using your life for the priorities of God that has allowed the success that we've had in reaching the unchurched. So that's what we're going to talk about today is some of those priorities. But before we get into that, I want to propose that there's two key facts that you have to square up to when it comes to this area of lifestyle evangelism. And the first key fact is that you will spend your life on something. There's no way around it. You know, this day you're spending here today, you'll never regain. You can never get this time back in your life. It's being spent today. And that is the reality of our life. We are spending it on something all the time. We like to think that we're not spending, if we're not purposefully spending our life on something, that we're not losing time. That's not the case. We will spend our life on something. So the question is, are you intentionally spending your life on God's priorities? And I think this word intentionality is key because if we're not intentionally spending our time and our life on God's priority, what happens? Where will we spend it? The things of the world. Yeah. And, you know, there's times in my life, last week, you know, this morning, where I find that I'm spending my life on things of the world that I didn't necessarily intend to, but I kind of had a slow leak and that's where I ended up. So we need to grasp this idea that we're spending our life on something. A promise out of the Bible that helps me to keep moving towards God's priorities in my life comes from John 15:11-12, where God says, you know what? If you want to make your life joyful, if you want your joy to be complete, what's the formula? Love one another as I have loved you. So when I'm really convinced that the way to joy in my life is by spending my life on God's priorities, I'm much more likely to stay intentional. That is a conviction that you would be wise to pray that God would increase your faith in. That your faith would grow in this area of being convinced that the best way to have joy in your life is to spend it on the things of God. So that's one key fact that we must square up to. The other key fact that we really, it's hard to take some time, is that God has given the world the right to evaluate Him and His promises, His word, His Son, based on what they see in our lives. He's given the world the right to do that. You know, our lives are not neutral communicators about God. Our lives are constantly communicating something to those pre-believers about God. It's either affirming His message and His character, or it's eroding His message or His character. We like to think that it just really doesn't change people's impression about God at all, but that's not what the Bible teaches. Let me give you this analogy. Who remembers the old sitcom Bewitched? Okay, Gladys Kravitz, the nosy neighbor. You know, God's kind of given the world the right to be Gladys Kravitz's in our life. Where, you know, she was constantly trying to pull the blinds and peek in to see what was really going on over in that house. Because something didn't add up, you know, between who they said they were and how their life was being played out. And God, you know, I don't like Gladys Kravitz that much. She's annoying, isn't she? Yeah, that's pretty annoying. But, you know, God has said the world has the right to look into your life as a Christian like Gladys. Yeah. And so instead of being the Darrens in the world who are constantly trying to pull the drapes and to keep Gladys out, we are supposed to open our windows, open our blinds, come out behind the privacy fence and live our lives. And as we do that, God says we have the opportunity to support His message and His character.
Yeah.
Now, the problem is, we're afraid of that, aren't we? Because we're pretty messed up people. We blow it all the time. And it's scary to think that we're going to let people into what's really going on in our lives. And then we get this false thought in our head that says that if they really knew how you were, that would erode the message of Christ. I don't think that's the case. So, a key question to ask yourself is, what does Gladys see when she peers into your life, into your marriage, your parenting? In fact, what do your kids see when they peer into your life? Is your lifestyle consistent with what you're telling them is true about God and His Word? It's a good question to ask. Your work, your finances, how you handle stress, driving. What do the other people on the road see when you're driving your car, John? You know, these things matter whether we intend them to or not, and people are looking, and God's given them the right to. So this is not about putting on a good front when we open the blinds to our lives. It's about being real about ourselves, about our failures, about our worries, about our anxieties, about our shortcomings, about our successes. It's about being real. And we can be real because we have the grace of God in our lives. And so I can say to my neighbor next door, John and I are really struggling right now in our marriage. It just seems like we've come against one conflict after another. And it's hard, but I'm not hopeless because I have the grace of God in my life. And He could come in and make changes that I can't do on my own. So instead of shutting her out of what's really going on, I have the freedom to let her in because I'm covered by the grace of God. It's about communicating I'm broken just like you. The only difference is that I have the power and love of God to bring about change in my life. That's the only difference between us and a non-Christian, is we have the power and love of God in our lives to bring about change. You know, some of our best testimony for Christ comes from our failures, not from our successes. So let's think about this question. What's the ultimate compliment that a Christian can receive? Is it, "You've got it all together, John. Gee, I wish I were just like you." You know, the problem with that is, who gets glorified when people think we've got it all together? We do. And, you know, most of the time, we're not that good of actors. Most of the time, the people observing our lives know we're more screwed up than we know. Yeah. But if we fooled some, you know, then we're trying to take the glory. The ultimate compliment a Christian can receive is, "You make me want to know the God you know." Mm-hmm. "You give me hope that things can be different, not because you're so awesome, but because your God is so awesome, and I want to know more about who he is." That's the goal of openness in our life. And it's also pretty good for us on the flip side. So, and it is the goal of an ambassador. You know, an ambassador's goal is not to draw the third party to themselves, mm-hmm. but to draw the third party to the person that they're representing or the entity that they're representing. And so that's our goal, is not to draw people to us, but to the God that we know, who is an awesome God. So being an ambassador is something we've all been commissioned to do. And, you know, as you read in Matthew 28, and he says, you know, "As you're going, make disciples of the world." Did you notice there aren't any exemptions there? There is nothing that says, "Do this after you have your career in order, when you're done with college, when your babies grow up, when the teens get out of the house." There are no exemptions. It says, as you're going in your life, as you're going through the things that everyone has to process through, take my love with you and give it away to the people you encounter. So that's our jobs as ambassadors. He's given us this message of reconciliation that gives us eternal life and a heck of a lot more personally. But also, what comes with that is this commission to protect it, to carry it, and to give it to other people. And so John's going to talk about some of the practicals of that.
Okay. Well, on your outline, I think we're at point number two, which is the picture of lifestyle evangelism in the early church. And just to follow up something Connie said, we came around this fellowship, which was, I guess, our first church experience at any time in our marriage. And it was the first time for me since I had been a boy, when we used to go to a lot of churches because my dad was in politics, so that was the reason to visit a lot of churches and make speeches. And so it had been years since I'd been in a church. And one of the things that struck me that I guess, you know, I'm very thankful for the chance to be part of Xenos Christian Fellowship, but I think the main thing I want to share with you by way of illustration is that I think because Xenos wasn't part of a traditional church with a board and a denomination and a charter, things like this, they were able to kind of make things up from scratch. And so without going into the full history of this church, the founders of this church started meeting in a house on a college campus in the early 70s and tried to create a church experience much more like what you read about in the New Testament. And as we turn, for example, to Acts chapter 2, many of us may be familiar with the Acts 2:42 church, where we have, you know, I guess a snapshot of something that must have been really exciting to be a part of. It says that continually, day to day, they were devoting themselves to what we would call the means of growth, to the apostles' teachings, to breaking the bread together. They were having all things in common, that they were taking their meals together from house to house with gladness and sincerity of heart, that they were having all things in common and sharing with those who had need. And it says, day by day, God was adding to their numbers, and they were constantly having favor with all the people. And so we have this picture of a church. We know that they had large meetings where they met in temple courtyards, but they also met from house to house. And when Connie and I, you know, we were in our moment lying on the street, and it was a coworker of mine who actually was kind of my rival. We both started with the company at the same time. He was taking the fast track in sales. I was in marketing with this company in Columbus called CompuServe, which was really doing well throughout the 80s and the 90s. It was Chester who called me into a conference room, shared with me that that our son was with Christ, that this God was not someone who was punishing us, was abandoning us, and to come find out maybe the answers to the questions that we had, that as we looked and talked with other ministers, with friends, with family, you know, we just didn't have anything that satisfied until we began to hear the Bible taught in some of these large meetings. But then it was when we got into a home group that I guess the idea of going to church once a week was radical. I mean, that was a big, big step. And the idea of going twice a week, I really thought that I guess my friends, the people at work, really thought that, you know, well, John, you know, he lost a son and, you know, he must really be searching for something. But, you know, I am so thankful that somebody had the courage to invite me out to their home group. And it was actually we had moved to Columbus. We had this big house on the college campus, didn't know a soul, had moved up from Dayton, Ohio. I was such a loner that, this just by way of illustration, we had a U-Haul. My mother had bought us a dining room suite to go in this beautiful Victorian home. I didn't know anybody, so guess how we got all the stuff in from the U-Haul? China cabinet, a buffet.
12-seater table.
12-seater dining room table. I carried it in all by myself.
Oh, my.
Connie was pregnant, so up 3 flights of stairs, through the door. Every piece of furniture, that was the only way that I knew. I didn't know anyone, and I was certainly wouldn't intrude on someone to ask for help. But this is the way I am, and I guess as I meet a lot of other guys, that's the way a lot of guys are in America today. And we go in and we shut our garage doors and we kind of look the other way if somebody's coming down the street. That's just sort of the way it is these days. But when I saw this home group, and I felt this sense of awe that everyone had in this group as God was doing things, as conversations were happening that were things beyond anything that I'd ever heard in my family. Even when people were drunk, they only talked about things, you know, about how they felt about each other or things that were real for maybe a half hour at a time. And then it got really ugly, so we didn't do that anymore. But this picture of a church, you know, it was electric. And, you know, I guess I like to think of things in analogies, so I'm going to share a couple analogies with you today. But one of the things that strikes me is that the lifestyle evangelism, the reason we're talking about this topic today, is that we are all wired to have a buzz. You know, we know that in the road to Emmaus, that after Jesus was crucified and some of these disciples were walking down back to Jerusalem or back to Emmaus with their heads down, it says, when they met Jesus and they had an encounter with him and he opened the word and explained the scriptures to them, they said, were not our hearts burning within us? And this notion of our hearts burning within us is something that God's designed for each one of us. And it's as the ultimate buzz is the buzz of being involved in a group that has the kind of sense of awe that they must have had in this Acts 2:42 church. I was a city boy growing up and my mother's family were farmers. My favorite thing to do in the summer was to go up and stay on the farm for a couple weeks. And my uncle, my mom's brother, was a great baseball pitcher. He was my idol. He almost got drafted to play for the Detroit Tigers, and I loved to go spend time with my uncle. And I remember when I was about 12, getting finally to that point where we were on vacation, ran up to the barn, my uncle standing inside, saying, John, come on over here. He's got a great big smile, something going on in his eyes, a big wink, and he comes over and wants me to shake his hand, and I shook his hand, and it was he had his hand on a 12-volt cow wire, and he's just waiting for the city boy to come over here and shake his hand. And, you know, that really stuck with me for more than a day. That stuck with me for a long time. But, you know, there's something really powerful to that image, isn't there? What gave him the ability to give a buzz to me that day? It's because he was holding on to a power source. And what was on his face as he saw me coming? A great big smile. And when did he get the buzz that he got to give to me? He had on rubber boots, and I'm not exactly sure all the theory of electricity, but I'll tell you, when he got the buzz was when he shook my hand. And because I was grounded on Mother Earth, you know, that's when I got the buzz, he got the buzz, we both got the buzz. The smile on both our faces was electric. And it was really something pretty cool. And, you know, this is the way it is with the Lord is, you know, after we've tasted and connected with the Holy Spirit, and many of us probably remember that sense of peace. For some of you, you may have had a buzz like that when you first came to the realization that God had forgiven you for your sins when you died on the cross. And I remember that moment. That was very, you know, God's promises. Paul writes in Romans 8 that his Spirit bears witness with your spirit, that you are his child, that you're adopted. And that same buzz is one that, as ambassadors, we get the privilege to give away as we're holding on to God and as we're extending our hand to the people that God puts in our life. That's the ultimate buzz. And that's apparently what was going on in this Acts 2 church. And so I guess as we maybe move forward and ask the question, what was it that was going on in that Acts 2 church that we could replicate in our houses today? And I guess as we're leading this workshop, imagine yourself leading maybe a home group of workers or people that have come into your home that are Christians, that are wanting to serve Christ, and you're trying to recreate something like this. Let's look at what are some of the elements that are present that provide a framework for becoming a magnetic kind of person, a magnetic Christian that draws people to Christ. See, one thing, and I'm not a scientist, but I did learn this, that wherever there is an electric field, it creates a magnetic force around that electric field. And I also learned something new, which is that when magnets, there's enough of a magnetic force, it also creates an electric field. So that you see, these two things go together. There's the buzz, and then there's also the magnetic power of that. And so as we think of the ways to become more and more engaged and magnetic for Christ, we can also do two things at once. We can increase the ability to draw other people into relationship with Christ, and also this joy that Connie talked about that we can make full, we can experience increasingly the power of God working, this buzz, this sense of awe in our own life. And this is pretty exciting. So what is a framework? Well, we have to live a magnetic Christ life for Christ, we have to be under God's grace. No question about this, is there? And you know, one of the things that jumps out at me is you read, for example, 1 Timothy, and Paul, as he's writing and he's sending Timothy to Ephesus to refute these false teachers, he's saying that some of these are teaching the law by the way they know nothing about the law, and they're using it for the wrong reasons. And they're, you know, basically using this to kind of reinforce how good they are and how screwed up you are. What does Paul immediately do in this letter and many of the other letters? He breaks into his testimony. He says, who am I? I am the foremost of all sinners. And it's under God's mercy that I am who I am. It's by God's grace, that it's in view of God's mercy, as he writes in Romans 12, verses 1 through 3. He starts with, it's under by God's mercy. Let us present ourselves as living sacrifices. And that this framework has to be under solidly under a real deep understanding of our own need for God's grace on a daily basis. Yes, we have to go back to this. That said another way, that I am a magnet, and I guess my north, let's just say it's my head, and let's say the back end of me, my tail, we'll say is my south pole, okay? Well, on my own nature, I am all messed up. My head's pointed squarely into the world. You know, that's just the way it is.
Where your backside is.
Well, I guess, but my head is into the world. And, you know, what God wants to do is God wants to realign us, that instead of just being an atom, so to speak, without any positive effect for Christ, God wants us to be charged with the Spirit so that we have an alignment where as our head is set and our mind begins to be transformed by God's mind to think the way God does, that we have a magnetic effect to, because so much of our alignment now is in alignment with the way God really designed us. And this notion of presenting ourselves to God is a twofold or bipolar kind of proposition. And it's 24/7, it's throughout the week. It's as Connie said, you know, with the neighbors watching, it's at work, it's in all parts of life, that it's involved saying no and saying yes, so that on one level there is an individual responsibility for each of us to increase our own magnetism as we become more and more aligned with Christ, because one magnet that's in line with Christ is going to have another similar effect on someone that's not. That's just the way God works. And so as we say no to being squeezed into the world system, we become free from a lot of the things that keep us from having a magnetic effect on others. And we know what a lot of these are. Freedom from many of the things that Tom was talking about, that Jim was talking about. Slavery to myself, my Holy Trinity, me, myself, and I. Slavery to sexual addictions, to the workplace being the place that I get my identity. That all of these things become areas where we are no longer looking for those things to be our God. Yes, that's an important way that God frees us by saying no. And at the same time, God, as we present ourselves to Him and say yes to His things, and our mind is more and more transformed, that we are able to have ourselves rewired, and that the emotions that we feel, that the ways of viewing things are no longer from my own perspective, but by the way God views them. And in this way, I'm much more able to be an instrument for God and effective to see things as God sees them, as Jim says, to love people that God loves the way that God loves them. And I guess, you know, what I saw in my own life is that for years I really was not putting my whole head toward God. My head was squarely toward the world, which meant that my backside was facing God. And when God was leading me, I'm like David, who wrote in Psalm 32, don't be like the horse or the mule, which is a nice word for my backside, who is hard to lead, who's, you know, needs has no understanding, who needs the bit and the bridle to be able to be leadable. You know, when we're not facing God, we can't follow God. He's got to drag us kicking and screaming to do the things that He wants. And so we can't pretend to have a something that we'd call a lifestyle of evangelism if we're not authentically saying yes to God in our own lives. And this is where our kids, where our neighbors, where people in the workplace, the things that are magnetic to other people about who God really is can only be manifested as we take seriously this point about saying yes to God. We had the privilege of having Oswald Sanders here, who wrote a lot of books on Christian leadership in 1984. And I know that one of the things that really struck our lead pastors is, you know, like many of us, if we're leading other Christians, what we often think, the most important thing is to see them making progress. And that if they make progress, that's what's really going to get this church going. And what Oswald Sanders pointed out is what Paul instructed Timothy at the end of 1 Timothy 4, verse 16, is that as you take pains with your character development, with your teaching, with your gifting, as you are absorbed in them, and as your progress is evident to all, that by doing this you will ensure salvation for yourself and for those who hear you. So this aspect of becoming a magnetic leader, a magnetic Christian, being a spiritual influence for others, we have to start first by looking in the mirror, as Jim said last night. We have to take this seriously, and we have to say yes to God. We have to say no to the being squeezed into the world system, and as we do so, our alignment has its maximum magnetic effect as an individual. Now, and I guess what God promises there is transformation that's visible from the inside out. It's character, it's fruits of the Spirit. These are things we can't manufacture. And these are the things that provide that magnetic effect. So we look at someone being transformed and we'll see someone that's having a magnetic effect for Christ. Now the next is that it has to be in the context of community. Community, diversity and unity, that we are designed relationally to be in community. And why is it that this is such a powerful way to have a lifestyle that reaches others for Christ? Well, I guess as we think of the new commandment that Christ gave in John 13, repeated in John 15, which John repeated several times, that you love one another the way I have loved you, that this one another effect is we come together not just as individuals who love God and have been transformed by God, but also have this love for one another going on, that's like the electric current and the magnetic force working together. It's like an electro transformer. And if any of us have been around junkyards, we know that these can pick up cars. You know, they have really powerful effects. And it's got a super powerful impact on each member that's part of that kind of community. And so as we are involved in this kind of, and I think this is where being in a home group kind of model or a cell group, small group model, where people know each other really well, that this is where is people minister each other as they exhort and encourage and teach and bear one another's burdens and fulfill the law of Christ. This just increases the magnetic draw of the Gladyses and all of the other people in the neighborhood that want to be part of something like this. This is something we're all desperate for. That this is, I guess, where as a leader, it's also where you were talking about being real, Connie, and what was striking me is that if I'm putting my head toward God and I'm leading, really part of what being real is that instead of me facing and having the nice face to all my people where they see all of the things that are going on that are nice and polished and above the surface, they're really seeing kind of my backside here as I'm following Christ. And if they want to follow where we're going, you know, there's nothing to hide here. And, you know, let's face it, our kids can critique our backsides better than anybody. And, you know, the people in our groups who know us, our friends, you know, there's really the only thing that we have to offer to people is not that we don't have a backside and there's things that God's still doing in our lives, but it's to be ones who can talk about it and tease about it in this kind of context. So I guess one of the things as we think about our meetings and as we talk about sharing things like what's going on in our marriages, as we share some of the real stuff that's going on, and as we know people outside the meetings where the things we're sharing aren't the things that happened, you know, 6 months ago or, you know, 33 years ago when this thing happened to me, but these are things we've been talking about last week. And so what we're pulling out of the refrigerator isn't something that's really stale. You know, this is something that's really fresh that communicates to people, hey, these folks really know each other. And that, you know, when their marriages are having problems, they're talking to people about it. And in fact, they're even inviting this couple to go with them to counseling so that outside of the counseling that they can be working with them on some of the things that are going on. Yes, this power of community is something that I guess that was probably the last thing that I thought I would really understand when I went into a home group, was how comfortable ultimately I would be with people knowing what's really going on in my life. And that the opportunity that God gives us as we begin to engage people at this level is a chance to become part of something that we've really designed to be a fabric, a living body, where Christ is the head, where every member has a role, and that this then has a polarizing effect where it's, on the one hand, when it's present, it's something that really does serve almost like this electromagnetic force that draws people to want to become part of it. And yet when it's not there, that it's almost worse than just the electric fence being turned off. It's still a fence, and it really is communicating. There is a buzz to it, a negative charge, when we don't have unity or where we aren't loving one another. That it can have an effect that really has kind of a distasteful effect for people.
Repelling.
A repelling effect for people who, you know, are really trying to find the true north just like we were. So this notion of community is probably one of the single most important aspects of the framework that we need to be effective for Christ.
And I would add to that, I think it's in community where we learned, where we learned how to experience God's grace so that we could be real. We had the encouragement to be real. We had the forgiveness when we were real. You know, it's there that we really learned how to give away. We didn't know how to give those things away because we'd never experienced them ourselves. Yep. So we had to learn that, and the community is where you can learn it.
That's well said. So this magnetic life, so we can move on to point four, has to be the medium to make the message compelling. When we think about communication, we've got a message, we've got the medium, we've got the sender, we've got the receiver. This magnetic life has to be the medium for the message of God's grace to be real, doesn't it? So let me ask, I guess, you some questions. What does it look like to have the medium, to have this loving one another going on without the message of God's grace? What does that look like?
To the receiver.
What does that look like to the receiver? What's that? Okay. Okay, good. So that without God's grace, it could have a real suspicious feel to people who wonder how they could ever fit in or be part of a group like that. Yes.
Okay. Or why they would want
or
to be.
Or why they would want to be part of a group like that. That's right. Yep. Yep. What does it look like if we have this love for one another, but we're not telling other people about it?
Or they're not seeing it.
If they're not hearing the message, they're not seeing the message, what does that look like? It could look like a support group.
This,
yes.
What? Maybe we don't feel they're worthy or God wouldn't feel they're worthy.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So they may feel like an outsider, that I really have no place here. This could feel exclusive, yes.
They could also take it as being insincere because they wouldn't have a context of what's the base for.
Good. Good. Yes. See, this, I think you're onto something here, because this is something really the world has the least category for, is this love that that God says that we can have for one another, that's not something that's drummed up out of my own feelings or out of something that I just naturally get out of this this relationship. This is a self-giving love, not a taking love. So have you heard this notion of, I guess, I was talking with a friend of mine that's working on our deck this week, and one of the things that he felt like, you know, he'd lived his life as a silent witness for Christ. Have you thought about that? I guess that you're living your life as a silent witness for Christ. Well, I guess on one hand, we are always being witnesses for Christ. People are watching us. But what's the problem if we live our life as a silent witness? Denise? Yes, that's right. They don't know how to get it. Yeah.
So. If I was on trial, I wouldn't want a silent witness.
Okay. Why is that, Vicki?
You know, this witness who gets up on the stand and just kind of sits there, I'd be like, you know, where are you coming from?
And yes.
You're not communicating everything there is to communicate.
That's right.
There's so much more that can't be communicated just by your lifestyle.
Good.
Even though it communicates a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mindy?
I was thinking, too, like two things. Like one, you were saying earlier that if our purpose is we want to draw people to God, and when they see our lives, they want to be like, I want to meet the God that you know. It'd be really difficult, I think, in a situation like that, for people to understand that if it's because of the relationship with God. I think you'd probably be thinking, oh man, you just got together, and go around like, man, this person's such a great person. Hopefully, I'll be like them someday. You know, and it would become like that.
That's
and
right.
I also was thinking too, like, if I wouldn't want my life to be on trial either without the explanation of grace. You know what I mean? Like, if we're saying we should live open lives and let people look into the windows and see what's going on, like, they're going to see sometimes, oh man, this person is so cool, but they're going to see, oh man, this person is messed up and they're a hypocrite.
Yep.
And I think that people have the misconception of thinking that Christians are hypocrites if they sin, rather than, you know, like Christians being hypocrites if they can't forgive and things like this or whatever. But I just think that they would think I was a hypocrite.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think the other thing that happens in that situation is that when you just have the community or the, you know, the love supposedly without the message, and I'm not sure how that happens, but that group's going to implode. Because, you know, the love, God's love is designed to be moving love.
Yes.
And when it's just, you know, kept inside the little community without the message to bring other people in, it's just going to become oversaturated and the enemy becomes what's within.
Yeah. Yeah, in the book of Acts, Peter says, we just couldn't stop talking about this message, right? It couldn't keep the word imprisoned. So, yeah, we don't want to stand in front of the judgment seat of Christ and say, well, I took the Fifth Amendment on this, you know. That's the kind of thing that I think of quite frequently is that, you know, how many times we do have the opportunity, and it's as we tell people about God's grace that, you know, when we're thirsty and that message is exactly what we need to hear, boy, that's what's really contagious. And we have to keep the medium and the message together. That's where the real power is. Yes. What are practical ways that if the action is in the harvest, if we are to go, we're not to try to, I think as Tom Stipe said this morning, that God didn't say, come, you know, and bring them into my church. He said, go, and while you're going, make disciples. What are the things that prevent us in our lives from being effective at getting out into the action where the people that need to hear about the message of Christ are? What are things that are barriers? Yes.
One thing for me was fear of rejection.
Okay.
Being well rejected, yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So there is that fear of rejection. Yep. What are other things in your lives that you find? Isn't that true? Just the day-to-day distractions? Yep. Time leaks? Yep. As we think of being intentional in our schedules, some of the practical things I know that we've had to do is to carve and to protect time where spontaneously that we can get together with neighbors or that we can be intentional about planning ahead to ask people over for dinner. So that our time doesn't completely get taken away by the busy things in life. That's something that's really practical. Some of the things Tom was talking about with that pastor that lived on the cul-de-sac was, you know, trying to make your place the center for where your kids' friends can come play, where there are things that are happening on the block to be able to have your house open so that you are hanging out on the front porch. We just built a front porch that we like to sit down on, and it's amazing how many more people of your neighbors, you know, that we see just out on the front porch. Yeah, these are good questions to ask ourselves. What does the message of Christ look like, or the message of the Bible? How do you think it's interpreted today in today's culture without the medium of God's love? Why is it so important that we have this love of Christ, being the aroma of Christ, being this magnetic power that people sense? What happens if they hear, or I guess, what do you think people's perception is of the message today without?
I think we live in an information age that we do.
Okay.
Things that we have to try to sift through and understand and see if they're relevant to us. And so without that hands-on love.
Yes. Good. Yep.
Yeah.
So there's nothing compelling about the message. Yes. Do you think people understand the message today? Do you think they even know what the message is?
Depends
where the message comes from. Good.
You have to look at them. For instance, the media standpoint, you have to be not skeptical or not cynical, but you have to be aware of the message that's coming across and who's giving it.
Yes. Yeah.
It seems like, I know one of the things that blocked the message for me for years, I grew up churched until I started calling myself an atheist at 12, and I told my mom she could keep make me go, but she couldn't make me listen, was that the hypocrisy of the lifestyle of the people in the church just completely negated the message.
Yeah.
And so I thought I knew a lot about the message and enough to reject it. And I knew really very little about the real message because I knew very little about the love.
Yeah. I guess back to your point about the confidence of overcoming the fear of rejection. You know, I guess one of the things that gave my friend who invited me the courage, or I guess to, you know, take me aside at a really awkward moment was that we did have a relationship. And maybe back to your point too, Scott, and to your point about this just being a dry piece of information, is that one of the ways God's love is really manifested is through these relationships. And, you know, really as we do mix it up with our neighbors and as we talk with our friends and even our family, that yes, we may be rejected, but as we each just do what Paul does, you know, and share your testimony. Each one of us has a testimony, and I think that's probably one of the most real and powerful things, you know, for that we could probably use a lot more often as we, you know, consider sharing with our friends, as we listen through what's going on, that you know, that this aspect of humility and gentleness that Tom Stipe was talking about today, that I think that's what we have to lean on, and to, you know, remember that, yes, I am with you till the end of the age, that you can be strong and courageous, and you can share this thing that is probably exactly what this other person needs to hear. Yeah.
And I would also say, you know, think outside of the box. Your testimony is not merely your conversion testimony. Your testimony is your day-to-day life.
Yeah.
Every day that I allow God to speak to me and to give me hope and to help me through a situation, I have a new testimony.
Yeah.
And, you know, it seems like it's those testimonies that we negate and we don't share, but they are the fresh. They're, you know, it's not that our conversion testimony is ever stale.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the most relevant testimony we have may be that, you know, we had to work through this issue with our kid.
Yeah.
So keep asking God to show you the testimony, the new, fresh testimony you have to how he's working in your life.
That's
yes,
good.
Sir.
One of the things that we found in some of the work that we've been doing in the traditional church is that the people have a different view of what spiritual caregiving really is. There is caregiving, and then there's spiritual caregiving.
Mm-hmm.
And one without the other, of course, is completely void.
Good.
What the Lord has asked to do.
Yeah,
asked
that's
to
right.
Do.
Absolutely.
And we have so many people that really don't understand, they feel that just the caregiving itself, you know, is the spiritual aspect of it. It is not.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, you can fluff a pillow, and you can give a glass of water, and you can pat them on the head, and you can leave, and there's no spiritual talk at all.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
That's not spiritual caregiving. And I think there's, at least in our crew, in our church, there's a lot of people that don't understand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It's well said. And
a good thing that I've done is you study, like, the book of John, for example, and you go chapter by chapter and work with your disciple or somebody and go through and say, okay, let's identify the different needs that Jesus meets. And one thing that you see in all his interactions with people is, yes, he meets the caregiving needs. He meets some social needs, but all throughout, he always meets the spiritual need. It's a really convicting study. Might be something to try.
That's great. Well, Connie, let's turn this to practically speaking and look at maybe three areas that especially we as leaders could take a look at.
Okay. So I'm going to talk about a couple of attitudes that are key attitude areas for us to have ourselves, but also to want to duplicate in the people that we're spiritually leading. And that is the first one. Let's look at the difference between stewardship versus ownership. When you are practicing lifestyle evangelism and it's all of your life, that means that all of your stuff is going to come into call. Your stuff, your talents, and your time. So what's the biblical principle of stewardship versus ownership? Who can summarize that? Yeah.
The story that we read is Jesus was getting ready to go into Jerusalem when he told this person to go get the clothes that the Lord needed.
Mm-hmm.
He might use what we have.
Yes.
He wants us to know.
Yes, we have a part. And, you know, because God is the creator of all things, really all of these things, our times, our talent, our resources are not ours. They're his. He's loaned them to us. And so these are his things that he's allowing us to use, and he's calling on us to use as part of his work. Lifestyle evangelism on a very practical level requires you to get used to using these things for God's priorities. That seems so easy to say and so difficult to practice. Every week, I probably have 50 to 100 people through my house every single week. I spend a lot of money on toilet paper, or I say we do. My carpet looks trashed much of the time. I am sleepy most of the time. People have problems that I have no idea what to do with them. And so I spend time praying and wrestling with God on, you know, what is my part here. There's a lot of things that, because my life is not my own, that God asks me to expend for Him and His priorities. My flesh hates that. My time is my time. My stuff is my stuff. And my talents, I should be able to use them when I want. And I think, you know, we are wrong when we approach this idea of stewardship versus ownership super spiritually, where we say, oh, yeah, you know, everything I have is God's. Unless you're Jesus Christ, I don't know that you can be in that mindset in this country much of the time. So I guess I would just suggest that you pray and you ask God to show you what are the things that are yours that I'm holding on to, and that's getting in the way of my relationships with the non-churched. What are those things? And then instead of me just trying to muster it up and change myself in these areas, you know, help me to go to you, God, and ask you to bring about this change in my life. Those are really big things. We don't change about ourselves, but God will change them as we ask Him to do that. Most of the time, though, that we have to identify that we care about those things and having our clutches on those things much more than we're willing to admit.
Yeah.
Because it's hard and it's embarrassing to consider that, you know, maybe you would prioritize, maybe you would be more grumbly about having to buy toilet paper again than somebody's salvation. You know, of course I don't, but sometimes I do. So don't deny that we have some of these attitude issues. Ask God, expose them, and then change me, and He'll do that. We also in this area need to learn how to let Him work on a process level. You know, I didn't go from coming to my first Bible study to having 100 people in my house every week. God grew me to that over time. And I think sometimes as we're leading other people, we're expecting people to get there because we're there. And we end up burning people out to evangelism before they've had a chance to be convicted and changed by God. So I'm not saying you don't question people and you don't exhort them to consider this, but remember that where you are, God's had some time to get you there. Mm-hmm. So give people a little bit of space and pray that they would let God have His way in this area. So that's one attitude. Another attitude is the difference between integrating your life versus balancing your life. And I'm going to say, beware of segmenting your life by trying to get it in balance. You know, we try to balance work, home, ministry, play. What happens when we try to balance something? Pit one against the other. And so you get this one going really good, and your eyes off of that one, and it falls to the ground, and it, you know, breaks. The plate is destroyed. So we have to beware against just merely settling for balance. Balance is not enough in lifestyle evangelism, because you know what? There are always more good things for you to do, legitimately spiritual things for you to do, than you as a finite person can do. So balance won't carry you through. Instead, I think we need to ask God to help us integrate our life. What does integrate mean? It means to really blend your life. So instead of segmenting work and ministry, you blend those things. You bring ministry into your workplace. And you know, sometimes that's a fine line. But we're looking for integration versus balance. I think being intentional with stewardship and getting your mind straight and your heart straight in that area does a lot for integrating your life. It seems to me that integration flows to a large degree out of intentional stewardship. And then I would say, in this area of integrating, we're probably going to need to lean against our tendency. Some of us tend to fill our lives with far too much. And so before we know it, we are spinning plates. You know, Jesus only had 12 disciples, and he was the Son of God. If you're involved with more than 12 people, you might need to, you might need to lean in a direction of slowing things down. Now, some of us need to let God make our world a little bit bigger because we like to be in control, and we like to be on time. We like to be even early, and we like to have all our ducks in the row. And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with being on time. I like to be on time. Yet sometimes that gets in, that interferes with my ability to really be effective with people. And so in integrating our life and in allowing God to expand our lives so that we do have room to talk to our neighbor, even if I'm going to be a few minutes late connecting with my disciple. Sometimes, you know, things that I have to do. And, you know, these are two areas, these areas of owner of stewardship and integration are areas that take time to process. You know, we're not going to arrive there. We're always going to be a work in process. But it's something to think about and pray about.
Yeah. That's right. And as leaders, I think there's things particularly that we have the opportunity to model. If this is really an apprenticeship life, where that this lifestyle, if we want others to adopt it, it's something they have to see in us. I guess one of the things that I guess struck me that as we got involved in home group work was we have to realize that, you know, just as Paul wrote Timothy in 1 Timothy 1:5, he says, the goal of our instruction is what? It's love from a pure heart, a clear conscience, and a sincere faith. But if the goal of our instruction is love, we have to model that love in our own life and in our relationships, and we have to be with the people that we want to influence where the action is, which is by the front lines. And I guess once again, for why we feel so strongly about, you know, the role of the church really being decentralized, where it's out in the neighborhoods, that it's something where the role of the pastors is, Paul wrote in Ephesians 4, it's to equip the saints for the work of service, where we're getting all of the members of the body engaged, that the role of the leader is you will replicate what you replicate in really in your own life. So as you replicate this this love in others, and as you begin to live a life where we're leading the way, this is going to look like going with people where, I guess if we're going to go, where we want to go? We want to go often to where the connectors in our group, where their friends are. There's a book, I think it's by Malcolm Gladwell, called The Tipping Point, that's a really interesting book on movements. And there's a lot of interesting points in that book, but one of the dynamics they talk about is that there's kind of three groups of people that are vital to any movement. The first group is what he calls connectors. And these are people that, for whatever reason, they just know everybody. And, you know, and if you want to know so-and-so, well, you talk to Julie over here, because Julie knows Sally, Jane, Robert, and they just are connected with all these different people. And, you know, I guess as a leader, as we identify the connectors in our group, and then as we set up times to go meet the friends of the connectors, this is one of the ways that our group can get connected and use the gifting of the people that God has brought into our group to reach their friends. Their friends may not come to their group, but they are connected to lots of people who would probably be willing to have lunch with so-and-so, especially if there's someone in the group that, you know, has got a natural affinity, you know, some common interests, or has been through something that their friend's going through. But one of the things we can do as leaders is identify our connectors. They're often the ones where, as we put our prayer list together, our connectors may have more than half the names on there next to them. They're not necessarily gifted in evangelism. They're gifted in connecting. So identify our connectors, and as leaders, try to hook up times when you can be with the connectors, or when the second group of people, who are people that are really gifted at asking questions and exposing some of the spiritual needs in people's lives and sharing the gospel and making the invitation, they're the Andrews, who were very good at saying, you've got to come see so-and-so. You've got to come see Jesus. And he'll bring Peter, and you know, and that's the role of an Andrew. The guy like Matthew is maybe more of the connector. He's going to have the big party. And so that's where, you know, then I guess this third group of people that he talks about are the people that have a lot of the wisdom, the knowledge. They aren't necessarily the people best connected. They may be the teachers. They may be the people who are the disciplers in the group. But as we look in the group and we see how can we start a movement, well, I guess a lot of the things that we see as common to all movements is that the connectors, the people who are, so to speak, the evangelists or the salesmen, and then the people who have this body of knowledge, that they're working together as a team to be out and talking and connecting with people that hear a sticky message, is what the book Tipping Point calls it, a sticky message. And this is where I don't know of a stickier message than God's grace that's being communicated in a medium that's got the aroma of Christ or this power of God's love working among a group of people who have learned about this message that God has for the people that they want to share it with, that God's brought into their life. So being out in the front lines, this means in the pool halls. You know, as I think of the people, Connie and I have had a chance to be in we started in this college home group in the early 90s, and then when the college students got married and started to have kids, we planted an adult home group in 1998, and that group planted again 2 years later, and again 2 years later, and again last year. And so we're on, I guess, like our sixth group. But the people that we see coming to Christ are often through the parties that we have. And we have our parties in pool halls, at putt-putt places, at Scioto Downs, which is a horse racing place. You know, these are places that aren't wine tastings. Often in people's houses in our groups, because their neighbors will come to those houses. With our connectors are often the ones that we want to have planning the social calendars that we have for our group. But these are really intentional. It's also a lot of fun, but they're also very intentional opportunities where in this setting, people, we can have spiritual conversations with people and ask them the questions about things going on in their lives, and then talk to them about these things that I guess we call them home groups, but they're life groups, really. Groups, you know, where people are built to lead or built to live. These groups where we get together, where we're all kind of learning about life, and it's a Christian group, and that the ultimate life coach that we're learning to follow is Christ. But from a practical standpoint, we have to be with them and in the front lines so that we're equipping our folks in how to have the conversations, how to ask the questions, how to share your own testimony. These are things that we just have to do on an apprentice model so that people can learn just on a day-to-day basis what this looks like. Here's something really practical. As each of us have maybe meetings in our churches, are we continually asking ourselves the questions, are we keeping them sensitive to people who don't know Christ? Meaning, are we defining the terms that we use as we explain the scriptures? One of the things that we find happens very quickly is that we each have our own vocabulary. Some of it's just biblical vocabulary. Some of it is church vocabulary that's common to your church or our church. We have to define these terms before we use them, or even terms like struggling or wrestling, mm-hmm. or
accountability
that's or you know, all these different terms they need to find to make sure that we're not miscommunicating something that would be misunderstood. But are we explaining the gospel, and are we explaining and talking about things that would be relevant to anyone who's in the room, including maybe the four people who don't know Christ? And even if they aren't present, are we always assuming that the person that's in that empty chair is someone that doesn't know Christ, so that in every meeting we're communicating the gospel, the good news, that we have this gravitational pull that happens to all of our groups, I think, where it tends to get more and more closed and for the Christians in the meeting instead of being first sensitive to the guests that don't know Christ. and then speaking to those of us that know Christ. It's always helpful, I think. We don't want to exclude the Christians or not talk about how this applies to our Christian life, because people who don't know Christ want to try this on. They want to see, well, what does it look like on you? And as then they hear about how this helps in a situation where someone's got a real bitterness issue with their parents that they haven't been able to resolve, and how this has now manifested itself into an issue in the marriage, because now, you know, there's an emotional withdrawal from one spouse to the other because of this thing. These are things that are very practical that can be discussed in these kind of home group communities. So are we working hard to keep our meetings transparent? Are you delegating and asking for help? You know, this is one that, boy, I have to keep asking myself, because I'm still the guy that carried all the furniture in all by myself. And I find now that I'm just doing the same thing in Christian work so many times. And that if we really want, I really enjoy some of the works by Ken Blanchard with The One-Minute Manager and One-Minute Manager Builds High-Performing Teams, Situational Leadership. Some pretty good concepts for discipleship, but also for the idea that the role of a leader in a group is to provide what the group can't provide for itself. But ultimately, you will never, ever, ever have an empowered, self-directed group unless you let the group do the work. And so this is something that we have to think about as leaders, is where is our group today? It's going to be a different place if it's just starting up versus if it's planting. Where is the group, and what are the things that I can only do for the group so that I can make sure the group knows what the charter is, knows what our direction is, knows what our mission is, knows what their role as workers are, but then how can I get out of the way and let their ideas and let the group begin to fulfill the work that that God's given for those saints in the group to do. Are we leaning against the tendency for us to do everything for the group? Yes, this is a good question.
And I will say that personally, as the leader, if you're doing everything in the group, you're not going to have time to reach out to your friends.
That's true.
Because we've been there many times.
Yep, that's right. Are we really exhorting and extolling through prayer the things that we're talking about that are the real priorities? Do we make it a point to spend time in our time together to ask how it's going with the people that we're reaching out to? I think these are some of the real things that we've learned, that if we're not doing this, the group's going to tend to drift back again to becoming kind of a closed Christian group. How are we praying? Are we praying for the people who don't know Christ on a regular basis? Do we have a prayer meeting? I think we'll hear Joel Comiskey, and one of his main points is that we can see a direct correlation between how much the group prays and how effective a group is at multiplying. Are we calling for a commitment to this as a lifestyle? You know, people need to know that the God that we serve is trustworthy, that He is ultimately completely trustworthy, that He is committed to giving you everything that you need in order to live this life that He's called you to, and that He has your best interests in mind before He calls you to commit to the lifestyle that He's called you to be His ambassador. But I think our people have to be convinced that is the only way their joy will be made full, that this is where they will find the abundant life, and that then we have to call for this commitment. So sometimes we don't have because we don't ask, and we need to call on our folks for commitment. We need to.
And sometimes we are calling for this commitment from our members when we don't have it ourselves.
Well.
And we almost, that's very, very damaging. And sometimes we apologize when we ask people to commit their lives to Christ, instead of helping to paint the vision that it's the best way you can spend
That's
your
right.
life.
Yeah.
But you have to be convinced of that yourself, and God will convince you of that if you ask Him to.
Yeah. So, you know, very practically, as we decentralize some of the things as we decentralize our weddings, our funerals, our baptisms, these are things that are really practical ways to push out into the role of our deacons leading the home groups to, take care of some of these biggest opportunities where people come to some kind of event where people can hear the gospel, they can hear things in a context that's, once again, where people know them, and it's in a setting where they can experience the kind of community that that group might have. So that's another practical way. So
wrap up.
We should wrap up, and I guess just by way of prayer, Carol, would you close us in some prayer?
You say are fearfully and wonderfully made and have great plans for each one of us. If, like Connie said, we're willing to pull back the curtains and take some scary steps of faith and be willing to embrace the idea of failing and most importantly in the context of really exciting things out there for all of us. I pray that you just stir our hearts to pursue that, Father, and help us be honest with you about our fears and the things that are keeping us back from that, God. And I thank you that also, like John said, that you know the heart of all of it is that you want you have really exciting things for us too, God. And I thank you that you don't want us to be bored, sedentary, weird, irrelevant people. You want us to be vital. For some strange reason, you want us to reflect to a dying and hurt world of who you are and what you're like.
Yeah.
And I really thank you for that.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, guys.
This presentation is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.